Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies. I'm Nick Cheeseman, a research fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Lynette Chua, an assistant professor at the Faculty of Law in the National University of Singapore, on her first book, Mobilizing Gay Singapore, Rights and Resistance in an Authoritarian State, published in 2014 by NUS Press and Temple University Press. Singapore has a well-deserved reputation as a state that stifles dissent and polices activism. But as Chua shows in this highly readable account of one community's efforts to mobilize for rights, repressive government always encounters resistance, even if the forms that it takes are not manifest. Turning away from social movement theory that tends to valorize public protest and other forms of highly visible contentious politics, she tells another story, a story of contingent, incremental gains through strategic adaptation. This program of careful, discrete tactics she labels pragmatic resistance. I'll leave it to Lynette to explain what she means by this term, but suffice it to say that Mobilizing Gay Singapore is not just a finely researched account of how a contemporary political movement has emerged and grown in a modern Southeast Asian state. The book also has much to recommend it to listeners interested in legal and political resistance to authoritarianism and in social movements more generally. I hope you enjoy the interview. Today on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, we're joining Lynette Chua to discuss her new book, Mobilizing Gay Singapore, Rights and Resistance in an Authoritarian State. Lynette, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So I'd like to ask you if you can begin by saying a little bit about how you came to this topic of mobilizing gay rights under authoritarianism, a bit about yourself and your intellectual interests, and then we'll turn to the contents of the book after that.
Okay. This project started out when I was at UC Berkeley. I initially was interested, actually, in the women's rights movements in various Southeast Asian countries, including, well, particularly Malaysia and Singapore. But after I did some preliminary background research on those two places, I noticed that the main groups working on women's rights in those two countries actually paid very little attention to sexual minorities or LGBT rights. So I was quite curious as to who's actually addressing these issues, if there are other groups that I have not noticed who are working on these issues. And so I started to turn my attention more specifically toward groups that worked on sexual minority rights rather than women's rights. And, you know, and I realized that they are, at least from my disciplinary background in terms of law and society research, there has been less attention focused on how activists in non-Western liberal democracies, how they go around making claims for sexual minorities and organizing collectively. So that was the initial motivation as to why I turned my attention to the issue of sexual minority rights, and particularly on issues on their collective mobilization. And so the field work actually started, prior to 2009, I was doing a lot of background research. I also did some preliminary field work, which actually involved, some preliminary interviews with women's rights activists. This was back in 2006, seemed like a long time ago. But then toward 2009, my project had really crystallized around sexual minorities and the gay rights movement, particularly in Singapore. And so in 2009, I really embarked on the most of the field work starting in 2009. So as somebody who is trained in law and society, coming from Berkeley's jurisprudence and social policy program background, I was really motivated to look at how, given the political and legal conditions that activists face in a place like Singapore, meaning that there are lesser civil political liberties that they have to enable collective mobilization. Under those circumstances, how then do they go about making their claims as a group of people representing a population that's been seen as marginalized and also discriminated against? What really intrigued me was their counterpart activists, for instance, in liberal democracies like the United States, when they mobilize on issues of gay rights, they often take for granted certain forms of civil political liberties, the right to assemble, the freedom of association, and so on. And so they don't have to usually worry about these issues, whereas the activists in the context like Singapore, in the process of making claims on gay rights or working on issues that concern sexual minorities, such as doing outreach work or giving or providing community service or social support, they also have to worry about these basic, whether they're infringing any restrictions on basic civil political liberty. So that adds another layer of textual nuance to understanding how collective resistance is carried out. So that was... So I entered the field very interested in understanding how they maneuver and how the context also helps to shape their strategies and tactics.
Right. You've emphasized at a number of points that you yourself come from a law and society research background. You had the interest in jurisprudence and social policy. Mm-hmm. And yet, I wondered then to what extent you were initially thinking about this problem as primarily a legal problem, and perhaps whether or not your ideas have changed over time, not to preempt too much of the contents of the book, but in some ways I read this book as a book that addresses many issues other than those issues that are typically within the domain of the law and society research. So was there a shift in the early stages of research in your own thinking about how to approach the material that you've written about so eloquently?
Well, I think, the phrasing or wording of the research questions were refined, that was refined over time. But I think the core motivation has always been there. I wanted to look at the strategies and tactics and the role of law in the way they formulate and carry out these strategies and tactics. I think it's always there. As the fieldwork progressed and I started doing analysis of the data coming in, it really the idea of, let's say, you know, the strategy of what I call pragmatic resistance really started to form, and then ideas about how they, you know, carry out the politics of rights start to become clearer along the way. So these are questions that these were findings that I did not necessarily expect when I first entered the field. But the central interest on strategies and tactics, knowing that, you know, they are probably going to be shaped by the legal constraints and also the political norms, had always been there. Yeah. I'm not sure about actually answering your question, but, you know, that's how I thought about it. And, you know, along the way, initially, when I was doing the field work and was doing many of these interviews, I actually was trying not to get people to talk directly about, you know, their thinking about rights. I was trying to get people to talk about how they deal with challenges and problems, how they go about achieving their goals in a way that may or may not bring up law, and that depends on how the conversation goes. But then later on, I realized that, you know, I would like also to know more specifically, given what they think about very common rights-based tactics like litigation, because there was not much mention. In fact, not many of these activists really brought up litigation on their own accord in these interviews. Now, bear in mind that this was, you know, in the years when the Section 377A of the Penal Code, the two constitutional cases had not really made it into the courtroom. So litigation wasn't really on their minds. So I was keen to know if they did not bring this up, how then do they think about it? Is it because they don't think it's important, or they don't know about it, or it's not really in the forefront of their minds? So I actually did made a conscious effort in the interviews. If the activists do not, the interviewees did not on their own accord bring up litigation, I would ask about it. And so in that sense, it was, you know, about law, more formal law in very specific ways. But at the same time, it was also shaped by what I was seeing as the fieldwork evolved.
All right. With these points, we're delving into some specific and very important features of the book. But perhaps before we go to questions of 377A, litigation, constitutional cases, and the strategies of pragmatic resistance, as you would describe it, we can start with the mundane beginnings of the book. You have a description of a specific event and the mobilizing of the community in Singapore around that event. So maybe it would be a good way to, again, start the story here, and then we'll move into some of those strategies and issues in more detail.
Sure. Well, the book opens with an account of an event that happened in 1993 in Singapore. It describes a police raid on what the interview is often described as a gay disco. Actually, it's an ordinary club that on certain nights of the week has a lot of gay patrons. So it's often known as a gay disco, gay club during certain times of the week. And police raid police raids were common in the early 1990s in Singapore on gay businesses, especially those who operate at night. And so the account is the police comes and raids the place, and typical of them, they ask for identification from the patrons. The patrons who had identification on them were not allowed to leave, whereas others who did not have identification on them were detained on the pretext of not being able to provide any form of ID and were taken to the police station. And the person who gave this account, one of my informants and my interviewees, was one of those people who had his ID on him, so he was let go. But he had to go and fetch his flatmate's ID because his flatmate was detained. And that made the incident got him thinking, and it also outraged him that the police could come in and raid gay businesses on, you know, these regulatory, on the pretext of regulatory infractions of, you know, for noise or maybe overcrowding in other cases and so on. So he decided to do some research, and he found out that actually the law does not provide for the police to immediately detain somebody who is unable to provide the identification. That person is obligated to provide identification, but he or she could, you know, go and fetch it and provide it to the police. And so he started a small letter writing campaign to write to the police and make known his grievances. And this is what that really struck me. Now, if you compare that to police raid on a very well-known bar, which is now a very well-known bar in New York, Stonewall, the consequence of that was there was a riot and a lot of street protests against the police's actions. But in this case, it was a very quiet sort of letter-writing campaign signed by about 21 signatories, basically complaining to the police that they had exceeded their legal authority provided by statute to ask for to detain persons who were unable immediately to provide their identification. And the outcome of this was actually quite interesting because the police responded and actually called this informant of mine and said that we have actually spoken to our rank and file and said that, you know, they can't do this and actually we're sorry about our rudeness. It was also written in a letter to him, almost a kind of apology. Few things are interesting here as well. The lack of confrontation, outright protest, that's one which I mentioned. And the lack of mention of a violation of rights by the police in this entire account. And the idea that they did not go public. It was written to the police and also to the Ministry of Home Affairs, which oversees the police. And these are some of the beginnings that got me thinking about the strategy that has endured within the movement by different generations of activists, in the sense that their strategy, of course, it embodies resistance, which all movements do, but they are, at the same time that they try to achieve change incrementally, they also try to maintain They also try to make sure that the movement or the group of people do not suffer retaliation from the state. So it's the question of survival is also at the forefront of their mind. So hence, you know, looking at the political context, they know that confrontation is out. And also advocacy about rights very openly would also be something that they need to be careful about doing, and oftentimes they're discouraged from doing so. Also, you know, coming hand in hand with the non-confrontation is to give face to the government, and this means that not letting the government come across as losing control, losing its authority. So these are some of the ingredients of the strategy that I saw over the course of more than 20 years in this in the movement as well. And I use this account to open in the book because it's a sharp contrast to the more familiar story of the Stonewall riots. But also the motivation here is not just to say, oh, this is what happens in an authoritarian state and this is what activists do there and this is what, and in the Stonewall incident, this is how it takes place in an environment like the U.S. where open protest is more accepted or more common. It's not just kind of black and white dichotomy. I also use the contrast between the juxtaposition of these two to talk about how context really matters to how protest is carried out. Much of the scholarship focuses on social movements, also in law and society, more valorizes the kind of open public forms of collective resistance, and whereas the covert, more subtle forms of resistance are often seen as precursors or just foundations that will lead up one day to the open forms of protest. Whereas the point I was trying to make is that actually collective resistance can take place in a way that is covert, and part of that is because it's informed by the political context and how activists exercise their agency and the account that I use to open the book is an illustration of that versus, you know, the account that we see, or the narrative of Stonewall is a contextualized one as well, one that emerged out of a tumultuous 1960s where people participated in Stonewall and gay liberation afterwards were very much shaped or influenced by the very vibrant, open forms of protest of the 1960s in the U.S.
And you describe this contingent strategizing as pragmatic resistance. This is a term which is recurrent throughout the text. Would you like to say a little bit more about what that term means to you and why it matters for this study and perhaps also for comparative scholarship on social movements?
Sure. This was the impetus for this came from many of these interviews and a pattern that emerged from it in which activists, independent of each other, talk about pushing boundaries and towing the line. And this really is the essence of pragmatic resistance, which really is a strategy that seeks to not only advance the movement in incremental ways, the pushing boundaries aspect of it, but also towing the line, which is the maintenance of survival, making sure that the movement does not suffer from state retaliation to the point of being clamped down or shut down. And so it's this constant tension or balance between towing the line and pushing boundaries that captures the essence of this strategy. If you push boundaries too much, you become, you could cross the line, and that would be perhaps too dangerous and jeopardize the survival of the movement. But if you are too, you toe the line too much, too abiding, then you're not going to make much of a progress as a movement. So where is the line? And that line, or those lines, are actually informed by not just formal laws, such as illegal restrictions on civil political liberties, but they're also informed by a set of political norms that emerge from the way activists talk about how they interact with the state. So I've mentioned some of these before, non-confrontation, coming across as not jeopardizing the social harmony in the eyes of the government. Of course, non-confrontation is also, you know, subjective. It's what the state thinks is non-confrontational. So non-confrontation, maintaining the appearance of not jeopardizing social harmony, and then maintaining or adhering to or being law-abiding, upholding sense of legal legitimacy. Activists talk about how law has been used very successfully by the state to cultivate this idea that law abidance gives you legitimacy, and if you are disobedient to the law or you are a lawbreaker, it delegitimizes you as an activist, as a dissident, and your cause as well. So legal legitimacy. And then the fourth set, fourth type of norm that they talk about is not coming across as jeopardizing or threatening the status, the ruling party's hegemony. So these are the four norms, as well as, you know, and the, along with the formal legal restrictions, they make up this these lines and boundaries that activists try to push simultaneously as they try to toe the line as well. And this actually, the idea of pragmatic resistance to me is very much informed by sociological studies about sociology of culture, for instance, about how people interact with their surroundings and symbols around them, and adapt or respond to them accordingly. So it has that affinity with some studies in sociology of culture, and which has some roots in the American school of pragmatism. So that's how the term comes about. It doesn't really actually has anything to do with the fact that people would say, oh, these activists therefore are practical, they are pragmatic. It doesn't have that affinity. It wasn't from there, but it's more, the term that I use actually more influenced by, learnings from sociology of culture idea that activists interact with their surroundings and symbols and signs around it and respond accordingly. So this idea of pragmatic resistance is also not static, meaning that what we saw in the early 1990s, in the example of this police raid, which, by the way, is the raid on Rascals, so oftentimes called the Rascals Incident. That was the name of the disco. In the days of the early 1990s, the tactics that you see carried out under this rubric of pragmatic resistance is perhaps a little bit more timid compared to what is happening now in Singapore in terms of the gay rights movement. A little bit more open and much more assertive in the way they make demands. But I make the claim that they are actually all within the trajectory of pragmatic resistance, because they still fulfill the core essence of the strategy, which is pushing boundaries and towing the lines and adhering to these various political norms. What has changed, though, is that they have strategically adapted the strategy over time based on their experiences that they had accumulated over the years, and also based on, you know, how they interpret the political environment, how they interpret politicians as having perhaps shifted in their attitudes and in the way they respond to activism in general, and also to the issue of homosexuality.
Well, before we go to the phases of strategic adaptation, which you set out very nicely across a number of chapters of the book, I felt like your articulation of the political norms that people are working with in Singapore was a very powerful. On the legal restrictions side, I wonder if you can say a little bit more generally about, for listeners who aren't familiar with the Singaporean situation, about what sort of legal restrictions anybody in Singapore might encounter if they engage in the public movements or activities that in one way or another might threaten the interests of state agencies or other concerned persons. And then we'll go to the phases after that. So in short, what does authoritarianism mean in terms of legal restrictions in Singapore today?
Right. One example would be the restrictions on the freedom of association. So there is there are laws on that. For instance, the Societies Act, which actually is a piece of legislation inherited from the British colonial government. It requires any group with more than 10 members to be legally registered with the government under this act. And what that means is that, you know, the mission, the objectives of the group are subject to scrutiny and approval. And of course, the government can choose to not approve certain groups or societies that they deem to contravene the act. This could be on grounds of, let's say, public order or public morality or national security. And of course, you know, as scholars who study social movements or legal scholars, we know how broad these terms can be defined, especially in non-liberal democratic contexts. So that's one. And of course, and the consequence of that is such groups, if they're non-registered, the leader would be subject to legal sanctions, which can include imprisonment. And participants also could be subject to legal sanctions as well. The law has changed a little bit over the years. There are now two categories. One is the kind that automatically register, which means they don't have to go through an approval process. But these are actually, most of the time, these groups are innocuous groups like sports associations, sports clubs, and that kind of stuff. But groups that work on sexual orientation, this is an explicit term in the amended Societies Act, groups that work on issues like human rights or politics, they have to be subject to approval. And that means it's not an automatic registration. So that's one constraint. And not being able to be registered legally as an entity has other ramifications. For instance, it would hamper one's ability to raise funds because your organization does not have a legal personality, which means that many local companies or local organizations, others may be a little bit more concerned about supporting this organization. So that's freedom of association. Freedom of assembly. There is now this law that was passed in 2009. It's called the Public Order Act that constrains the ability of members of public to assemble and, you know, make claims publicly. Along with that, in the act, gives police wide powers. So, for instance, the police even has the power to order one single individual to move on in the public area if that person seemed to be perhaps going to be demonstrating or making a protest. Also give police great surveillance powers under the act. And of course, assembly is very much restricted in Singapore. You need police permits to be able to assemble or have a parade or demonstration. Now, of course, you know, in places that have given greater freedom to assembly, you know, groups also sometimes need permits to be able to close streets or march down certain areas. But oftentimes, in this context, you would see that permits are denied on the basis of, you know, the content. For instance, it could be seen as too political or too oppositional and so on. So not just looking at the basis of, not just regulating the time or venue of the protest and so on. And the only place that has some semblance of assembly where there's no need for prior application to the police is Hong Lim Park, which is a public park that the government actually made an exception for public assembly. But even there, which means that if I and a group of people want to speak out about an issue, I can go to Hong Lim Park and I do not need to submit an application for approval. But I do need, as an organizer, to pre-register with authorities, meaning that I therefore agree to preset conditions. So, for instance, I should not be talking about issues or making speech that could be deemed as racially or religiously sensitive. So that's assembly. And then on speech, public talks the default position is that you do need to get licensing. There are exceptions. So things like if you're indoor public speech and it's the speaker is Singaporean, you know, there's an exemption. But of course, the exemption is also on the basis of some of the preset conditions that you can't be too political speaking about racially or religiously sensitive issues. But whether or not what is deemed to be racially or religiously sensitive, as we know, is in the eyes of the authorities. So these are the various types of, just some examples of constraints on basic civil political liberties that do play a role in shaping the ability of activists, be they gay rights activists or others, to mobilize.
So Hong Lim Park, to which you're referring, comes out as very much a central part of the narrative in the late phases of the mobilizing of the Singapore's gay movement. But there are a number of phases preceding that, and much of the story of the book is taken up with these earlier phases. So perhaps we can work our way through them, beginning with what you describe as the timorous beginnings before 1997, then cyber organizing, 97 to 2000, transition 2000 to 2005, and in the park, coming out and mobilizing in the open from 2005.
Okay, so timorous beginnings would be in the early 1990s. That's where I trace the emergence of the movement to the second half of the 90s. It's timorous or timid because during this phase of the movement, you see some characteristics. One is that there were only a few consistent or core activists within the movement, and they were not really making claims that directly ask for reform from the state or changes. It was very inward-looking, focusing on issues of, self-acceptance among gay members of their community, or things like consciousness raising, providing support for one another, things like that. And they were also timid in the sense that when they were facing police surveillance or media attention, they avoided it, or ran away. For instance, they were actually... there was a tabloid newspaper that was it was trying to expose them as a deviant group doing something subversive. And so they completely diffused the situation and would not engage the media directly. This is going to be in sharp contrast to the later phases of the movement when activists actually actively engaged the media and loved publicity. And also in terms of surveillance, during this phase, one of the main groups, which I called the coalition in the book, were meeting for, once every few weeks at a theater space. And then they eventually realized that they were under surveillance. And this was particularly scary because for them, they were not registered. And also, given what had happened in Singapore in the late 80s when the government had put many social activists on detention without trial for working on other social justice issues, there's that memory of that, very recent memory of it. And so people were really scared. But their tactic at the time was actually not to become public and deal with the matter in that way. Instead, they quietly tried to register themselves to become a legal entity, and of course, that did not come out favorably. So they were actually denied registration on the basis that they are a group that contravened public morality and public order. So that was the very timorous or very timid beginnings of the movement. Then we moved into the cyberspace era. Having been under surveillance, many members, you know, ordinary members will come on these, come to these regular meetings, were scared. And so the numbers dwindled. People in the core leadership of the coalition were also very concerned, and some of them also dropped out. And so it came to a point, and then, you know, having been denied registration, you know, they did not dare to reconvene as a group that had a physical meeting space. Because, you know, the joke was that in the past, before they registered, they could say that we are meeting to get ready for registration. But now that the state has known that you have tried to register and then been denied, they felt that they couldn't still go ahead and keep meeting up. So the group sort of fizzled away. This actually coincided with the gaining popularity of the internet and the growing availability in public by the late 1990s in Singapore. So the movement actually, in a way, moved onto the internet. So people felt that they were able to congregate, quote unquote, in cyberspace and interact and meet in those ways, and also organize as groups in cyberspace. So it was an era in which, and this cyberspace era would be in the late 90s until the early 2000s. This was their primary way of organizing and meeting. Of course, you know, people might talk about meeting up, and then they do meet up, get together privately, go on outings or, you know, social gatherings. But a lot of these organizing work and outreach work was done on the internet. Most of it was done on the internet during that period, late 90s to early 2000s. Then there was a transition phase in the early 2000s in which you would still see a lot of groups working primarily on the internet, but then you start to see some activists, some groups becoming a little bit bolder and poking their heads out again and trying to organize in other ways besides being on the internet, being more public. The way one activist described it was, you know, in those years when we were sort of hiding away in cyberspace, there was no sting in the tail. The government didn't really come after them, and they felt that they were left alone for a while. And also, they noticed that, you know, there were certain statements being uttered by the government that perhaps signaled that, you know, homosexuality wasn't as completely persecuted or tabooed in Singapore. So, you know, for instance, they pointed to a Lee Kuan Yew statement in the late 1990s, where, of course, he wasn't, you know, outspoken about supporting gay rights, but he uttered something to the effect that the government would not go around actively persecuting gay people. And just little things like that. And then that they felt was a signal that perhaps it's time to sort of try something bolder. Then in 2003, another statement by the second prime minister, Goh Chok Tong, who actually spoke to Time magazine and mentioned that, you know, the civil service actually does not discriminate against gay people. Well, there's no, you know, I couldn't find any written policy about this, but the fact that he made a statement like this in international media was another signal that people felt maybe that, you know, the position of the government isn't as stridently against homosexuality. That shifted at least a little bit. So this was an era, therefore the transition era of the early 2000s, where activists started to come out and be a little bit more open about organizing and holding events and engaging the government. So the coalition once again tried to register. Now this is quite in contrast to what happened in the 1990s when they tried to register for the first time. This time, they did not feel that they needed to be legal in order to continue doing their work. This time, they really wanted to test to see how the government would respond to them after the Prime Minister Goh had spoken about civil servants, about the civil servants being accepting of gays. And so, they applied for the registration, again denied on similar grounds. But this time, the activists wrote, issued a public statement. They were also featured in a news report in the local newspaper about this matter. And so instead of running away from media attention, they actually courted media attention and wanted to make known their grievances, in this case being denied registration again by the government. And so you can see a reemergence emergence of open forms of engagement and in a way that shifted from the more timid approaches in the early 1990s. Then the transition period just set a foundation for what is still an era, the contemporary era of more open forms of mobilization. So from the mid-2000s onward, you see a lot of, you see the movement actually coming out into the open, and activists open about the fact that they are gay activists, or even about the fact that they are activists, which was not the case in the early 1990s. You know, people would not readily identify themselves in the media as being an activist or a gay activist. Now, late 2000s, they're happy to speak to the media and they want to speak about the issues. So from the mid-2000s onwards, you see more open and growing number of campaigns that involve not only, core leaders in the movement, but also you see a diversity of organizations. You see younger people in the movement. You also see straight allies who are also leaders within the gay movement or have tried to take on some form of organizing or leadership role, versus in the early 1990s when there are only a few handful of people who were in the thick of things. So by the and also in the mid-2000s onwards, it wasn't just the movement's constituents, meaning gay and lesbians, who are participating in the movement or giving it support. By the late 2000s, people who identify as straight beyond the gay community were supporting the movement. So you can see this in several major events like the Pink Dot, which is an annual public rally to show support for the local gay and lesbian community. You see people who come to this event who do not identify themselves as gay, straight, they do not identify themselves as LGBT, but they say they are friends or family members of people who are LGBT. And then also, there was this event in 2007, the Repeal 377A petition to the government, to the legislature, to repeal the provision, Section 377A of the Penal Code, which criminalizes, quote-unquote, gross indecency between men. That legal petition was signed not only by people from the gay community, but were also, parents and siblings and friends, co-workers, of people in the local gay community. So in recent years, you start to see that growth of the movement in terms of the types of support it was getting, the types of allies it was getting, and the number of activists and the more open nature of engagement that they were involved in. And of course, right now, there are two cases, there are pending judgment in the Court of Appeal in Singapore, which is challenging the constitutionality of Section 377A of the Penal Code. This kind of open litigation in the courtroom in the old days would be seen as too confrontational because they're actually taking the government to court. That's a layperson's way of interpreting the situation. And now activists feel that there's a right moment to do this. Whether or not the court will rule in their favor is still up in the air. But again, you see their way that you see how, you know, the movement itself has evolved over time up to this point, and it's still in line with the notion of pragmatic resistance, because they adapted that strategy based on the changing interpretation, based on their interpretation of changing political conditions, that now is in a conducive moment to litigate on this matter. And also, activists themselves, the younger ones, and also those who have been in the movement and gone through different phases of it, have learned from the past and have, you know, now are making decisions differently, because pragmatic resistance is not about being structurally determined by what's going on, but also accounts for how activists themselves make decisions and therefore exercise their agency.
So what I'd really like to ask, which is not part of the book, but you might have some thoughts about it, is then where to for the movement next? And does the use of this pragmatic resistance as an analytical framework provide, offer any possible explanations as to how the movement might proceed? Or is it really a question of contingency of the larger political circumstances in which these people are active? And perhaps in that regard, you might like to point briefly to one or two specific examples of how the movement is mobilizing in the open today and what it might do next. Or here, for instance, I'm looking at this eye-catching, colorful cover with the photograph of the pink dot. You might like to say a little bit more about what the pink dot involved and how it symbolizes the openness of the movement before we close the interview.
Well, let me talk about the example of pink dot as encapsulating more open form of more open type of tactic, but still within pragmatic resistance, that I answer your other question about the future. Well, Pink Dot, well, just now I mentioned Hong Lim Park and how it's an exception to the controls on freedom assembly. But of course, Hong Lim Park comes with certain rules that you have to confine your assembly within the park and abide by preset conditions. So when this exemption came around in late 2008. Activists, the first few activists who noticed this said, why don't we do something like a pride parade or a rally in the park, but within the confines of the park? There was a lot of negotiations and discussion among them about what to do, because number one, they thought that, well, a demonstration within the park going round and round doesn't quite make sense, because when you have a demonstration, it sort of connotes a linear progression from one point to the next, not going round and round the park. So, and also they, you know, they felt that the idea of protests and demonstrations have been vilified through by, you know, the prosecution of those who have tried to assemble or hold protests in contravention of a legal restriction. So that is, there's a lack of legal legitimacy in the acts of protest. So they were concerned about whether people show up and how they will come across. So finally, somebody said, why don't we just try this new idea of a pink dot, where it's not a protest, not procession. You just come to the park wearing pink and we'll take photographs. And so in showing support for the local gay community. So it was a very non-threatening, they packaged it as a very non-threatening way of assembling and getting together. And so when you look at it in that sense, it is actually pushing boundaries of what the political norm about non-confrontation, in the sense that you have a group of people and the numbers to these days amount to 25,000 in the park. It's a sign of strong support and a way against the official stance about still criminalizing homosexuality and still seeing it as not acceptable in mainstream society, despite the government's softer stance these days about not actively persecuting gay people. So it pushes that, and also pushes the idea of what assembly is, because when they hold pink dot, they take photographs, and particularly they take area photographs, and then they post it on the internet. So in a way, it pushes beyond the confines of the park where, you know, people can can look at the visuals and you know, see on the internet beyond, you know, what is physically demarcated along the boundaries of the park. But at the same time, and this is how it's also how it meets the essence of pragmatic resistance, is that they're very law abiding. They do not, they never ever broke out the confines of the park. They register the police. They are, then they make sure that they abide by the rules, and also that they do not come across as confrontation. The Q&A, the FAQs for Ping Da always emphasizes that they are not a protest. So this is a very example, a very strong example of pragmatic resistance, of towing the lines and pushing boundaries. So I'm going to answer next your question about the future of is it what happens next if the law is repealed? Is it right?
The law is part of it. And what else do you see about the prospects and possibilities for this movement? And perhaps more generally, might there be implications for this notion of authoritarianism as it applies to Singapore?
Well, I think that I don't want to say that the outcome of these two cases will be, you know, overall determining the future of the movement, but it will have some significant influence. If, let's say, the law is, the courts uphold Section 377A, it would more or less foreclose the possibility of decriminalization for a while. Parliament will unlikely change its position for a while as well. And so then what's next for a movement that is unable to get the law repealed? Of course, you can keep working on it and then try another time, you know, several years down the road. In the meanwhile, you know, I'm sure that the work on self-acceptance, on social acceptance, all of that will still continue. I don't see that changing, actually. But, you know, if the law is actually removed, struck down, however you call it, then perhaps you might see more efforts put into further legal reform. So things like maybe changing the censorship rules about portraying homosexuality in mainstream media, maybe starting to change policy on sex education, which now actually requires sex education trainers to tell students that homosexuality is illegal. So things like that, you might start to see more reform on the policy and regulatory front. These issues have not been able to achieve much traction at the moment because of the existence of Section 377A. So that's how I see things as possibly changing. But at the same time, you know, the community outreach and the social acceptance angle will continue whether or not the law is changed. That's how I would see it happening. And also perhaps, you know, the movement itself needs to start to address among themselves issues of privileging gay men and gay men and Chinese, English speaking, you know, and like movements you see elsewhere, you know, there tends to be privileging or giving more attention to issues the focus tends to be on the majority group. In this case, English speaking Chinese, perhaps more middle class within the movement. So it needs to start to address how to deal with the unique issues perhaps are faced by gays and lesbians who do not belong to these, do not bear these features, and working class, Chinese speaking, Malay speaking, other dialect speaking groups, women, more older members of the gay community, who may not necessarily identify with campaigns like Pink Dot and so on. So then they probably need to start addressing these sorts of issues within themselves, within the movement as it grows and becomes more successful. I think that their strategy, which has been pragmatic resistance, the way I call it, will probably continue unless, you know, there's a drastic change in the legal and political landscape. Now, one of the things that I've actually pointed out in the book is that at the end is that, yeah, the state also participates in this, in the pragmatic resistance, because there's a certain understanding of how members of the civil society in Singapore actually engage government, engage public officials. And so if one tries to break away from that norm, it would be quite interesting to see how authorities will respond, because they're sort of broken away from the script of pragmatic resistance. And that's not what I see yet with the gay rights movement in Singapore. But by adhering continuously to the script of pragmatic resistance, one could say you're going to be risking routinization, so that you're actually just continuing to make these changes incrementally. And some critics would say that that's just not enough. Could be lulled into a sense of complacency. I'm not, given that there are a mountain of issues that the gay rights movement in Singapore needs to continue to address, I am not sure how much complacency they could find themselves falling into. But that's always a risk of, you know, not being bolder with the tactics as well. So, I mean, things are in a way up in the air because of the two cases, but in many ways, it's also probably going to be business as usual for a long time, because the work on social acceptance and self-acceptance are always very important. The work on, don't use this, I sometimes avoid using this term of coming out, or at least being open about one's sexuality, is quite important in the Singaporean context, so that, and because that's linked to generating a sense of social acceptance. When you know somebody who's gay or lesbian, it helps to change perceptions or prejudices. Yeah, so I hope to see that go on.
Lynette, there are so many other questions I would like to ask you, but we are out of time. We've taken up a great deal of your time. And so before closing, having asked you about the future of the movement, I'd like to ask you about your own future. What are you working on right now, and what can we expect to see in the next few years?
Well, I am still following the gay rights movement in Singapore. The book ends with the two cases going to court. And so I'm doing a more confined study following the lawsuits and the activists involved in it, trying to understand the social process involved in getting the case to court and then the outcome and so on. So that's a project that's a continuation directly from the book. Separately, I'm carrying out field work right now, ongoing, on looking at the emergence of a sexual minority rights movement in Myanmar and at the time of political transition. So in a way, it's somewhat related to my research interests on law and social movements, but in a quite a different context, and taking a slightly different approach in trying to understand how a movement openly mobilizes the language of human rights in a context where that discourse has been very much repressed or alienated. So that's a separate project that I'm looking at. And in the longer run, I hope to, I'm working with a collaborator, look at a more comparative project, looking at various sites in Asia, comparing their different forms of LGBT activism, which is a rising phenomenon in the Asian region.
It sounds like there are many great opportunities for comparative work there, and certainly I, and I'm sure many other people, are going to look forward to your research output in the next few years. So, Lynette Chua, again, I'd like to thank you for speaking with us about your book, Mobilizing Gay Singapore.
Thank you.
And thank you also to everyone for listening. And until next time, I'm Nick Cheeseman for New Books in Southeast Asian Studies.
Monkey! Hey, thank us to get the tender boat. Monkey! Hey, thank us to get the tender boat. Monkey!